Hush words by law now.
Laws. Laws don't govern. Men do. The same men who governed before are here now in that room. They have his ear. They've got to be cleaned out.
First, the land must be given back.
And if Madero doesn't do it?
Yes.
Then he's an enemy, too.
You're his emissary, his officer, his friend.
I'm a friend to no one and to nothing except logic.
And as the man says, I'm loyal only to logic. I like that. That makes sense. That's right. Hey, there's Terrible Tommy in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a beautiful, beautiful day here in November. Can you believe it? It's getting into the 70s today, and the sun's shining all over the place, and the birds are tweeting and eating up my bird seed so fast it's going to break me up keeping seed in there. Yeah, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, as usual, 46581. And our big website is just waiting up there like Cambridge for you to open the door and enter into a vast amount of knowledge about race, economics, environment, and a lot of things. So it's free. Get on up there, boys. But in the meantime, for the radio show to get it every day, send in your $20 per month. And several of you have already done that this month. So you're often at it. And let's see here, what else? I saw something on the internet today that reminded me of the adventures and saga of Craig Cobb. There's a little town over there in Germany that has only got 100 people in it. And they're going to bring nearly 1,000 of these invaders into town. Now, this guy claims he's a National Socialist. And he says how wonderful it is for him, how great this will be. Well, sometimes that can work out. But if you've got... most of the people in town are, of course, going to be opposed to bringing all these people in into a little village of 100 people. So, he'll, number one, he'll first make enemies of everybody in town. And if these are non-white type invaders, he's not going to make many friends with them unless they're hardcore Muslims and he can talk about the Jews. So, strange. There's strange people in the right wing. I never am more amazed at any group of people than the right wing. Secondarily, it's a left wing, but the left wing, easy to figure out. They're easy to figure out. Well, they got this hacker group called Anonymous, and it's all sort of funny to me because I think hacking's great. You know, I've been hacked a couple of times and I survived. It's not something that's going to put you out of business. But they released their hundreds or a thousand so-called Ku Klux Klan membership lists. And that's funny. That's funny because they're putting congressmen and senators and everything else in there. And our senator here... from Indiana, Anonymous said he's connected to the Ku Klux Klan. Any self-respecting Ku Klux Klan would not take this guy in, I'll tell you that. But I'll tell you how this worked for me back in the old days when I was keeping membership or lists of names and addresses, a whole lot of them, you know. Well, the way I did it, I sprinkled the files with big shots in the area, in the region, in the country. I mean, you could find a senator's name in my list. You could find a congressman. You could find a chief of police, a sheriff. So I sprinkled all my lists with that kind of stuff. And so when the bad guys, if they could get the list, if they did get the list, well, they're going to be harassing a lot of people who are loyal supporters of the rotten, federal, state, and local law enforcement and everything else, you know, and politicians. So if you got a list that you want to keep, if you want to throw them off, if you're keeping a list, which I don't recommend it, then put a bunch of local dignitaries in it, you know, doctors, lawyers, preachers. Sprinkle them in there. And then if, these assholes get your list, they're going to cause a lot of trouble to the community. This anonymous, I couldn't do any better job if I'd have hired him myself. Number one, the Klan has served a purpose way back. It no longer serves a purpose except to, oh my God, honey, I found a Klan leaflet in the front yard. Or, comes on out here, baby. I see a 3-foot high cross of burning in our yard. What did you do, honey? Well, we went out there and just stomped it into the ground. Oh, but now I gotta call the NAACP and see if I can make some money on it. And of course the media go right along with all this bullshit and all the progressives over there. You know, the problem with the progressives, they don't understand the human animal. They think they're going to change the human animal, and you can move it over to the side a little bit and change it a little bit, but you're not going to change it very much. And that's something, you know, I see a lot of these progressives that are decent and not bad guys, but they, at the bottom of their philosophy, they think they're going to change the human animal. Ain't gonna happen. You can modify them a little bit, but you're not gonna change them radically. And so they keep beating their head against the wall, against human nature, or the human animal nature. So, but you can't explain that to most of them. No, they're just about as screwed up as the right wing. Yeah, baby. Well, I see the last kosher restaurant in Tunisia is closing up. Yeah, I guess now that they got a peaceful country, the Jews are closing up and leaving. I don't know what that means, but anyhow, the last kosher restaurant in Tunisia is closing its doors. I wonder how long it's going to take a hell of a lot of these migrant invaders over in Europe that are Muslims, heavy-duty Muslims, to start chasing the Jews around Europe. That's going to be funny, because you know it's going to happen. It's got to happen. It may end up that the Jews in Europe will come begging to the neo-Nazis to save them. Wouldn't that be a twist? There has been some strange twists in the last few years. So, we'll see what happens. Well, there was quite a bit of voting went on yesterday around the country, and here in Indiana they tossed a few mayors out and got some new ones and stuff like that. The old, what do you call it? The old bait and switch game. Yeah, and this guy's rotten for a few terms, and they say, well, we got to have another fresh young guy. And then the young guys, they get on TV and say, we're going to have a new city here. We're going to run it. It's going to be wonderful. And within 6 months, everybody wants to hang him, too. It's funny. It's funny. Well, what are we going to do today, boys and girls? We're going to go back down south with the Klan? Are we going to get into that Camp of the Saints a little more? Or what do you think? Huh? What do you think? That ain't telling me much. What the hell? Well, let's go back to the pessimist guide to history. I like it. Like I told you yesterday and the day before that, I like it. Okay, 1431 A.D. Women's lib here. Joan of Arc burns at the stake. It was Tuesday, February 21st, when a young French farm girl named Joan of Arc was led into the chapel of a castle in Rouen to face some 35 charges by the church, or the English judges, actually. Though Joan trembled with fear, she still believed her faith would protect her from harm. Well, remember, boys and girls, faith without evidence is BS. Faith is, like I say, it's believing something you have no proper or correct evidence to support. So that's sort of like playing Russian roulette. I got my faith, baby, so I'll be okay. Woo! The trial eventually lasted more than 3 months while the court considered more than 70 accusations against the 19-year-old girl. But her chief crime was that she had rallied the French troops during the Hundred Years' War, appearing at a time when all of France was in danger of falling into the invading British-English hands. And now that they were losing the war, the English wanted her dead. Joan was only 13 when she first heard heavenly voices and instructed her to help the French cause. Well, I think that's what Donald Trump did. I think he heard the heavenly voices and he'd come out to help the Republican Party. What do you think? Eventually, she led French troops to victory at Orleans, at Pathé, and on many other battlefields. Finally captured during the Battle of May 24, 1430, she was taken to Rouen, then held by the British to be tried for heresy and witchcraft. Oh, how do you disprove you're not a witch? The court, Hillary did. She proves she's not a witch. She got right up there for all those Republicrats that tried to get her ass, and she told them what for. And she smiled walking away. Those Republicans, they're not too bright. The court convened 40 times before finally reaching a verdict. Most of the meetings were in the chapel, but some were held in the prison, where Joan was either chained to a beam or locked in an iron cage. Boy, they really afraid of her. During the lengthy trial, Joan steadfastly defended herself by repeating she had been directed by God. Well, that's all you need. You've been told by God to do it, and by God you do it. Nobody should argue with that. The judges badgered and insulted her, calling her deceitful and dishonest. And besides that, you're just a girl. They claimed she was possessed by the devil. Woo, and refused to let her appeal to the Pope. Now, how did they know she was possessed by the devil? Strange people, these Christians. Finally, Joan, how come I keep saying Joanne? Maybe it's that comedian broad that died. What's her name? Joan Rivers? The Jewess. She was pretty funny once in a while. Finally, Joan was promised that if she withdrew her testimony, she would be turned over to the church. If not, she would be burned at the stake. Those Christians back there, they like to burn people, you know. They get pissed off at ISIS for doing the same thing the Christians did for hundreds of years. Terrified and in poor health, I think so, hanging from a beam in the prison. Joan signed the paper but put before her. No, Joan, don't ever sign anything. Don't trust the bastards. Only to recant when she learned that the court had no intention of letting her live. Duh. Well, I guess she was a farm girl. She wasn't wise to the rise. Her execution was already being planned. At 9 o'clock in the morning on May 30th, Joan was placed on a cart and led through the streets of Rouen to the fish market. Oh, what a put down. There, a huge stake of plaster and wood had been erected that struck terror by its height alone. As she was tied to the stake, Joan asked the watching crowd to pray for her. Then the executioner set fire to the kindling pile below her. The flames first licked at her feet, then grew higher as the terrified girl called to God, "Wherefore art thou, God? Save my ass!" The angels and the saints to protect her. Finally, the fire overcame her. Her head fell back, then forward, and she was dazed. The terrible murder failed to end the tide of French victories, and throughout the intermittent fighting during the ensuing decades, English-held territory on the European continent was reduced. You don't pay to try to occupy somebody else's land. Sooner or later, they're going to get it back. Joan of Arc was declared a saint by the Roman Catholic Church in 1920. Nowadays, she would probably be declared a schizophrenic. Well, I think she was a little bit schizophrenic, don't you? It always gets me how all these people down through history on pain of death were yelling, "God save me, God save me." Even Jesus said, "Save me." And God don't save any of them. Did he ever save any of them? I don't think so. Well, is that guy? Well, let's move on to 1453 and see what we can find this exciting. The fall of Constantinople. In the early hours of May 29th, the Byzantine Emperor Constantine the 11th left his family and friends in the imperial palace, knowing he would never return to them alive. 4 days earlier, the attacking Turkish army under Mahomet II had finally blasted a hole in the great wall surrounding Constantinople. It was about to become Istanbul, and now threatened to be captured the great capital city of the Byzantine Empire. Since the relentless Turkish attack began in early April, some 6,000 Byzantine soldiers and 3,000 other supporters had been holding out against the combined Turkish force of some 70,000 men. Well, I heard if you didn't bend over backwards, you was okay. Or maybe you should. I don't know. I get that mixed up about the Turks. I've heard rumors. But the Turks had also brought a huge cannon, the world's largest at that time, with a 2.5-foot bore. Oh, man! The monstrous weapon had been constructed for the sole purpose of destroying the city's walls. I wonder if that could have got through the walls of Jerusalem. Because, boy, those are thick walls. I'll tell you, I saw them. For 2 hours just before dawn on May 29th, Emperor Constantine and his men held their positions in the breach, knocking back wave after wave of crazy Turks. Finally, a fierce charge slashed through the line of defenders and killed the emperor. Well, it sounds like the emperor might have been right up front with his troops, which is honorable. Hordes of Turkish troops swarmed behind them, trampling over the slain emperor's body. The rampaging Turks at first killed every citizen they met. "Come here, boy, I'm going to kill you." Then took as slaves thousands who had sought refuge in the Hagia Sophia. They also plundered the city of its vast wealth. Well, I figured they'd do that first. Constantinople had fallen, ending forever the centuries-old Byzantine Empire, the last remnant of the vast Roman Empire. And to the victors go the spoils. I don't think it went too far. They formed this caliphate and it held on till World War I, and lying French and English and Americans screwed them out of it. Now ISIS wants it back. Well, you know, ISIS has got a point if they're true to the real thing, you know. What am I saying? They're going to drag me away to Washington and do something to me if I don't watch out what I say. Don't say you like ISIS. Okay, on 1456, earthquake destroys Naples. That's in Italy. It wasn't Italy then. Italy was a bunch of independent states. Some 35,000 people died when a massive earthquake hit Naples, Italy, on December the 5th. The quake left the city almost completely in ruins, whence the saying, "See Naples and die." Which reminds me, I watched a good movie on DVD last night about the tsunami a few years ago that totally pretty much wiped out that whole island nation down there in the South Pacific. And the true story of these this white guy and his white wife and his white kids, they had four kids, and how they survived it. That's a pretty damn good movie. I'd recommend it to anybody. I'll get the title for you. Yeah, the title of that film was The Impossible. I've seen a couple of those kind of films, tsunamis and earthquakes and stuff, that mostly go along with special effects. And the storyline is not that big a deal. But this was, it showed a lot of real footage of the tsunami that took out this island. But the main thing was the Aryan family, that how brave they were and how they stuck together and how they finally survived. And I'd recommend it to anybody as a good film, The Impossible. I've been waiting for weeks to get to this page. Wow, this is one of my favorites. 1459 A.D., The Many Horrors of Vlad Dracula, the Impaler. On April 2nd, Vlad II Dracula, Prince of Wallachia in modern Romania, entered the small town of Brasov and orders his men to begin the systematic impalement of the townspeople. Tyrant and madman that he was, he needed no reason for his actions. Some insult, real or imagined, could always be claimed. Thus, by the end of the day, thousands of Saxon burghers dangled from wooden stakes that had been driven through them. The stakes were then set upright in the ground in concentric circles on a hill near the town. Dracula capped this incredible atrocity by eating his dinner amid the gruesome scene, while his servants dismembered the bodies of the dead before his eyes. Man, talk about Halloween. That is a real Halloween. This behavior was by no means unusual for Vlad Dracula, the historical inspiration for Bram Stoker's fictional vampire Dracula. Indeed, his reign as Prince of the Wallachia from 1456 to 1462 was studded with such bloody escapades. For example, shortly after becoming prince, he invited all the beggars in the country to feast at his castle in Turgovista, Wallachia. After the unsuspecting guests had finished drinking toast to their benefactor and gorging themselves with delicacies, Dracula ordered the doors barred and the castle set on fire. By the next morning, nothing but ashes remained of the citizens whom Dracula considered an unnecessary burden to society. Those welfare niggas, we got rid of them in one night, man. We invited them to dinner, burnt their ass. Dracula variously had his many victims boiled alive, skinned, hacked to pieces, disemboweled, and tortured on the rack and the wheel. Sounds like Chicago on Saturday night. In the case of two Genoese ambassadors who refused to take their hats off in his presence, Dracula had their hats nailed to their heads with a spike. Dracula's favorite method of punishment, however, was impalement. The stakes were generally rounded at the ends and oiled so that his victims would not die too quickly. Quite often, the victims were forced onto the stake in an upright position. Oh, my piles! Oh, hemorrhoids! For variation, many were impaled through the navel, the heart, or in rare instances, upside down through the skull. Whoa, my tonsils! In 1462, Dracula heard that a contingent of Turkish envoys was coming to meet with him. I hate those Turks. I'm not speaking literally because there's a lot of white Turks, so don't start saying Tommy hates the Turks. Ostensibly to negotiate a peace, but in reality to draw him into an ambush, Dracula turned the tables, trapping the envoys and 2,000 soldiers who came with them, and taking prisoners to Turgovista. There, on the outskirts of the city, they were impaled and left to rot along with an incredible 18,000 others. 18,000 others? This guy was a mofo. Dracula decided to kill in an orgy of mass impalement. I love it. When the Turkish Sultan, Mehmet, arrived before Turgovista 6 months later, he was greeted by the stench and the skeletons of 20,000 corpses still impaled on stakes outside the city. This sight was said to have horrified him so much that he personally decided to quit the campaign. Not going to run as a Republican, no mo. Dracula is estimated to have impaled, tortured, and killed between 50,000 and 100,000 victims before being deposed and imprisoned in 1462. Though the exact circumstances are not known, it is believed Dracula was decapitated in battle against the Turks shortly after being released from prison in 1474. Well, my rendition of the story was that through his ruthless nature and the things he pulled off, that he kept the Turks and a lot of these other people out of Europe for a long time. Would you go to Europe if you're going to be met with this guy, man? Shit. Well, that's it from our book today. That's exciting. Vlad the Impaler. That reminds me, they got a new Dracula movie. I mean, not Dracula, but Frankenstein movie coming up. Looks really good. Now, tomorrow we're going to get into another one of my big favorites, the Spanish Inquisition. Whoa, wow, I'm going to have my popcorn and who knows. Well, let's spend another session in the Camp of the Saints. And right now we're reading what cowardly people, the white people, have become or had become in this book. And in fact, they went over and masses of them sympathized with these bastards coming in to invade their country as hundreds of thousands of these creeps were getting ready to storm the beaches of France. At the selfsame hour, 147 minutes ahead of the refugees, so-called refugees, actually landing, I call them invader bastards, the myth of the redemption of the Ganges Armada swept over the nation's industrial zones in plant after plant. Once again, we should point out that this coincidental occurrence was in no way due to any preconceived scheme on the part of the principals or to any concerted action by the usual phalanx of outside agitators. If the third world factory workers of France rose up in spontaneous revolt that night in places as far removed from one another as Paris, Lille, Lyon, and Mulhouse, it's because for the last 3 days the pent-up tension was built to such a pitch that the lid finally blew in a seething eruption of wild expected hopes. In ordinary times, no one would have dared to take such risks. Every man was intent on keeping his job and his hard-earned pay. The unions, of course, worked hard to recruit the swarthy rabble and would throw them into the fray from time to time as the rules of the social war game demanded, though really with an eye to improving the French workers' profits perched up at the top of the salary scale. I think this guy was a little bit anti-union. let's see. The best proof was the fact that the places like Rodeo Chemical, for example, and a few other highly politicized plants where the Great Emancipation revels had already begun on the day before Easter, the Third World workers had resisted temptation, sticking grimly by their machines, like a stray dog still clinging to a bone-gnawing white. But that didn't stop them from thinking perhaps they weren't willing for others to share their fabled redemption, that symbol of a million refugees landing in France to signal their deliverance. They had lived their exile alone, despite the occasional hand of friendship held out over the flood of false promises, and alone they would be resurrected. So you see what's happening here. The rabble and the non-whites that have been used in the industrial complex and in the manufacturing business are getting ready to join up with the invaders, which will happen here too. This idea that they're going to become USNized. No, when they get enough mass and they get enough power and there's a breakdown in this country, they will turn four square against the system. They had lived their exile alone despite the occasional hand of friendship held out over the flood of false promises, and alone they would be resurrected. When the factory loudspeakers had broadcast the final words of the president's message, the unions lost all control. The political spells exploded, and even Cadet One-Eyed in Paris knew that now he could never keep his people in check any more than he'll hold back his wife, Elise, speeding to the studios of Radio East, a razor hidden in her stocking. To be honest, we have to admit, however, that the crimes committed that night, for the most part, had no needless cruelty or malice about them, no excess or subtle finesse, but seemed part of the natural order of things. One might have feared that this was to be the first wave of a fierce brewing storm. Instead, it was the one last visible tremor of an underground upheaval, and it quickly subsided since the country had drowned in its waters long since. Besides, one thing is sure, even if Western-style law had survived with its weighty decisions about justice as we knew it, the courts would have judged each one of these crimes as quite defensible on the social grounds, going through the motions for appearances' sake and handing down suspended sentences, or light ones at most. You see that now with a lot of the blacks and other non-white criminals. There's a whole army of progressive judges in this country. And most white guys, white people in the same situation don't get the breaks. The first such crime was a model of Jenner. It was staged in Bicêtre in the slaughter room of a pork packing plant. The charcuteries, Olo by name, the three Africans who worked there, niggers, of course, Stunner, Hoister, and Slaughterer, respectively, could go through an average of 190 pigs an hour in two or three cut and dried moves, each one repeated 190 times. A grisly and gory job, and one that the regular help would have no part of. Several hundred workers depended on these three men, the one on the sausage line, stuffers, stringers, and sorters, the ones on the tinned plate line, packers and sealers, not to mention the various supervisorial personnel, the wholesalers, the retailers, as well as an assortment of executives and stockholders. That one of these three indispensable killers suddenly have to take himself a pee and the whole production would slow to a crawl. Such breaks, therefore, were quickly forbidden, to return for which the three were rewarded with a few extra francs per day. They just had to hold it until the end of the shift, man. I got pay! What the front office jokingly referred to as a bladder compensation. Now it happened that just that night the management, sensing troubles to come and the shortages sure to follow, in their wake came the conclusion that food would be Trump's and that the industry stood to make a killing if only huge stockpiles could be laid away in time. And so the order went out through the plant to step everything up. It reached the slaughtering room moments after the end of the president's speech on the lips of the assistant production manager himself, with the promise that the bladder bonus would even be doubled. "Sure enough, boss," one red-splattered black assured him. "We can show enough, do one more at least." The white man felt no more pain than any of the other pigs in the line stunned, hoisted, and slaughtered, and hanged from the hook. Between two blood-drenched hogs, he started into production. As he moved along through each successive phase, growing less and less like man and more like pork, it caused a certain amount of interest, but no special disgust. They had seen such things before, after all, at the market in the Congo, except that is for a few white women who promptly took to their heels and swooned dead away. As for the foreman, they just turned and ran. They had read the blank looks on the faces of their slaves and had gotten the message. The third world workers went on with their jobs, conscientious as could be, even into the final labeling of the tins where the white man's remains ended up in pate. Perhaps even ate some of him ourselves. As time went on and conditions grew worse, we tended to be a good deal less fussy. Worth noting, in passing, was a certain worker priest, sausage stringer by trade, who said a little prayer as he tied his last knot and then murmured, "Forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do," at which point the production line stopped, since all the police headquarters that night were deluged with complaints of much of the same kind, which they found rather hard to believe, and since the commissioner left to shift for himself with a pack of demoralized men, had decided to wait until morning to look into the matter. See, they were slaughtering white people. The officials at the plant were quick to agree that the whole affair must have been an accident, an explanation, in fact, that they likely put forth themselves. "Well, now," the manager ventured, after a minute of silence, "shall we all get back to work?" "Sure enough, boss," replied the trio of nigger killers, turned labor leaders all of a sudden, like 90 pigs an hour. "Man, right, so France will just eat less. Tough shit." And they added with their calmest pleasantry of smiles, "Of course, man, from now on we get half the take." 5 minutes later, having emptied out his safe and handed a few envelopes to his faithful watchdogs, the manager snatched his family on the run and made a dash southward, headed for Switzerland, only to be swallowed up in the great glut of cars and the shortage of gasoline. Once again, the reader wants a few more details just for the record. We might mention that this gentleman was spotted for the last time on foot not far from Saint-Favier, of all places, where the Arabs, not content to have the swimming pool to themselves, had co-opted their way into the town council as members of a dominant minority and had finally taken it over. The poor man would never be heard from again, all of which explains how charcuteries, olo, and bicetra finally came to be run by the workers. In the hellish hubbub of the Croix de Javille in Paris, where third world labor amounted to better than 80%, the revolt took on a liturgical form, like a mass or a ritual sacrifice. When you take into account the fact that the profit potential of the automobile industry relies on assembly lines strictly timed and placed, it is no surprise that poor, uprooted, illiterate folk subject to all the concentration camp fallacies, fancies of a wildly disparate, retribalized existence should have endowed the timers, those high priests of Clock Almighty, with all the coercive and sacred powers of religion forcibly imposed by the masters. Their resistance to this new faith depended on a kind of secret intrigue, replete with a whole spate of catacomb rites. If they wanted to catch their breath on the line or settle their nerves or just stop for a moment and muse on their distant palm grove or the big muddy river running its course between the grasslands and the dunes, they would rush the prescribed moves through, then loll over the conclusion as if they hadn't, daydreaming without letting on, hand resting on the tool in question, pretending to work. And during these precious moments, they would cast quick glances among themselves, fraternal glances that bespoke the same loathing of the clockers' steady pace, as much a rejection of the new religion as a need to rest. But the clockers were always there watching. No room, after all, for two cults at once. And they would speed up the rhythm or divide the jobs to make them simpler and quicker. When you've manufactured cars, it's no good to dream of exotic palm groves and kneeling down nightly in prayer facing Mecca. And so when the redemptive myth of the Ganges burst into the scene, it was towards those million messiahs that all hopes secretly turned. This became quite clear at about the time that the Sao Tome affair, when the Armada had reached the height of fashion, and the famous slogan, "We're all from the Ganges now," was dished up for every political and philosophical cause. Huge demonstration, but rather short-lived. Some 80,000 workers massed by their motionless assembly lines, shouting two slogans that seemed on the face of it wholly unrelated. "Get the clockers off our backs. We're all from the Ganges now." Then things calmed down and returned to normal, though the unions was surprised by the spontaneous uprising, had tried to keep the movement going so that they could take it over. Failing that, they settled for the adopting of strange Manichaean battle cries that pitted the Ganges refugees and the clockers against each other as symbols of the eternal struggle between good and evil. The cry that they shouted through this plant and that, just to show that they were still a force to be reckoned with, in spite of the social tranquility decreed by the beast to lull the world opinion to sleep. The clockers, at least, were given bonuses for the risks they faced. And the days went by until that night when one of the time gobblers chosen amongst the ruthless of the lot was trussed up like a sausage and laid on a piece of sheet metal en route to the bloody assembly with a sign in Arabic around his neck. "For now, the 1,000 years are ended." When the massive drop hammer fell against the metal to stamp it into shape, the clocker was nothing but pudding of blood, quickly dried in the heat. A great war, a roar went on up, and the assembly line stopped as thousands of Arabs next to their machines fell prostrate towards Mecca and gave thanks to Allah. The underdogs had had their scapegoat, and that was that. There were no other climbs in Jabal that night. They needed only one, and everyone understood it. If we want to pursue the historical facts a bit further, here too, again, just for the record, we might point out that cars are still coming off the assembly lines at the Jabal plant, though were awfully expensive and terribly scarce. They're reserved for a choice for the officials of the new regime to buy one himself. A worker in one of those people-run plants would have to pay 10 times what he makes in a year, a pleasure he can ill afford. He can take consolation, however, in his using our public conveyances, chaotic, decrepit, or joining the rest of the ill-shod pedestrians thronging the streets. When the author of these lines returned to Paris after a lengthy stay in Switzerland, his car was surrounded by breathless little urchins as if were some new kind of toy. Of course, when they saw the Swiss plate, they jeered and sneered. There was no changing that, but we mustn't digress. In other industrial towns, Billancourt, Veneçoux, Le Mans, and the like, the rhythm of the Western life floundered and drowned in quite the same way. The fact it owed its existence to the Third World's sweat doesn't change the picture. One can even claim, at the risk of prison or social extinction, that under the Western regime, the Third World did work efficiently, at least. It would have been best to take pride in the fact and establish a just master-servant relationship instead of groaning with shame at the height of our prosperity. But why complain now? It wouldn't have made any difference. Not really. With millions of us, billions of them, we couldn't have held them out much longer. Now we're swept up in the Third World tide, and it's clear that their instinctual drives have won out of hands down. Everything has changed. The way people talk, the way they behave, the rhythm and the rhythms of life, the play of emotions, the level of production, a whole new outlook, even their way of not giving a damn. Then, too, with sexual appetites given free rein, it seems that the white has become Third World, though the Third World hasn't turned white in the bargain. Clearly, they've won. For every old Ahmed who moans in private that things are better under the French, though he hardly remembers if he's talking about his native Algeria or his adopted France. How many millions scrape by on their share of this monstrous welfare budget, telling themselves that the wheel is turned and that equality, at least, is no empty word. Such, more or less, was the prophetic vision, unintentional, no doubt, of a French or young West Indian girl that night at her job in the Croisy electronics plant, exclaiming simply that she plunged a screwdriver into her supervisor's breast. Quote, plantation days are over, a remark with a lot of history behind it. Occupied, too, that night was the hallowed pavement of the Boulevard Saint-Germain, but this time for good. To comprehend fully the scope of the event, we have to go back to a few years, to the scene of the racial crisis that Fouchada, a black against white, the Café Odeon, faced with example of urban America, fallen little by little into total decay. Certain observers had seen the confrontation as a sign of inevitability, though they took care not to say so in print. That wasn't the kind of thing one wrote about those days, nor will it ever be again. The pure conscience, on the other hand, roaring out of a mighty chorus, endless variations in every key on the famous theme. Yeah, could that, no dogs and no niggers, hyperbole is to be sure. That wasn't at all what the owner of the Café Odeon had said at the time was this. I've been running the Café Odeon for almost a year and a half. It's kind of bar, ice cream parlor combination. Most of my trade are Africans and West Indians. Anyway, on December 27th, while I'm out of town, two tough guys took over the other table and crushed out their cigarettes. Right on the table, I mean. So the help kicked them out. The next day, the lady complained that some characters, in trying to give her a hard time, one of the waiters, the name doesn't matter, goes over and tries to straighten him out, and he gets roughed up so bad he winds up in the hospital. When I get back a week later, I put my foot down. Don't serve any troublemakers, I tell him. Well, that's when they started giving me the business. Frankly, I can't take any more, and it's a losing game. I'd rather close up. And he added, without thinking, leaving himself open to the usual epithets and insults. I low, do you like that? Oh, how do you like that, calling me a racist? Me, a Jew, who fought against the Nazis tooth and nail. It was easy enough to understand what had happened. The blacks had decided to take over the Cafe Odeum and had proceeded to make life miserable for the whites who frequented it. Now, it's known fact that racism comes in two forms, that practiced by whites, heinous and inexcusable, whatever its motives, and that practiced by blacks, quite justified, whatever its excesses, since it's merely the expression of a righteous revenge, and it's up to the whites to be patient and understanding. Boy, is that's what's happening now in the white world. There was even the time in Paris when an American black power leader came to the site Universiaire to speak to the student rally and began his speech by shouting, "Now listen, I see you've got some black brothers and sisters standing and some white folks sitting. Come on, white folks, let's give us those seats," unquote. And the most amazing part of it was the ones he was talking about got up meekly as lambs while the others applauded. At the Cafe Odeon, things hadn't gone that far. The whites had held tight. They weren't there to make trouble, just to sit and drink their coffee. They weren't there. Still, their very presence rankled and struck the blacks as a calculated slap. They wanted it their way. Hence a string of those nasty harassments that the Paris of the day found it distasteful to condone at the risk of public censure. The whites, as a result, began to keep their distance, and the owner, seeing his business about to fall apart thanks to a wholly one-sided clientele, took steps to shore it up by refusing to serve certain blacks, and not any black, as the papers at the time so shamelessly reported. Poor man, from that point on, every black student in Paris took turns in his cafe, spitting on the floor, breaking glasses, glowering at the help, crushing out cigarette butts on the walls, and the like. He closed up 2 days later, and his flight was hailed as a noble victory for the universal conscience. The battleground, however, spread to the neighboring establishments, whose owners, much more clever, hung on in different ways with unending rap sessions and much licking of boots trying to keep their investments from sinking. The Cafe Odeum had been sold for half what it's worth, and the value of the building whose ground floor it occupied was already taking a great plunge. That was the way matters stood, more or less, until the Easter Sunday night, Monday morning. The President of the Republic had no sooner finished speaking than the streets of the quarter emptied all night. In anticipation of his address, suddenly came alive. 20,000 black students, mainly, and a muttering of young diplomats streamed over the hallowed pavement. Alsace-Lorraine had been retaken, and this time they would never let it go. They came from every corner, from their West Indian bars, from their African dance halls, their rooms at the site Universiaire, wherever they had been holed up, waiting, expecting the impossible, and hoping for the inevitable. At Cafe Odeum, one of them stood up behind the counter and declared, "A round for everybody on the house." The example was followed in the neighborhood bars. But only in one did it threaten to cause trouble. The owner, not a man to be trifled with, grabbed his ever-ready pistol from the till and brandished it at a crowd of submerging his bar like a great spring tide, at which point a hulking brute from the Guadalupe head of some student activist group or another went swaggering up, hands on his sides, and stuck his chest squarely in front of the barrel. He apparently had a first-rate memory and a talent for imitation, because standing there eye-to-eye with the owner, he proceeded quite simply to recite, and it was as if the president himself were speaking. "And so I'm asking every soldier and officer and every member of our police, asking them from the depths of my conscience and my soul, to weigh this monstrous mission for themselves and to feel free either to accept it or reject it. To kill is hard, even harder to know why myself. I think I know, but I don't have my finger on the trigger, and my gun isn't aimed point blank at some poor soul's flesh. My friends, whatever happens, may God help us or forgive us." Having said this, he burst out laughing to his friends' applause. It was a curious moment, as hatred gave way to the subtler emotion, as they were sorry to see the balance shift and to lose that antagonism long and advantageous to the blacks of their position. Rising above the uproar, a voice cried, "Come on, boss, have one on us. And tomorrow, if you're a good boy, maybe we'll even pay you for our drinks. Cheer up. We all got to live, don't we?" Quote, "Not at this price," the owner muttered, shrugging his shoulder. Throwing down his gun, he pocketed the contents of the till. Then he walked out into the night straight ahead without looking back. As the crowd stepped aside, they let him pass. A moment later, on the boulevard, he found himself forced into a doorway as a solid mass of flesh came surging down the sidewalk, refusing to give him an inch. The drudges of the depths had begun to swarm through Paris. At this point, a little-known event took place, one that historians, in their wisdom, prefer to pass over, since many a feather would doubtless be ruffled in today's high government circles were to be discussed. We speak of the frenzied flight of all the coat and tie blacks before the army of Africans, swill men, sweepers, and troglodytes and menials. They were led by their witch doctors, needless to say, especially the chief, that hero of the dismal cellar and the ragged ragtag priest, apostle to the slums, Latter-day Cardinal Lavagiri, himself evangelist to the niggers and to the do-gooders of note. Ever since, some of their number had begun sweeping gutters in those wee small hours, when their gentlemen brethren would pile onto their cars parked all day on the hallowed pavement. The myth of a black utopia had spread through their cellars and under the sheet metal roofs of their hovels. The tribal princes were worst offenders. What on earth did they have in common with these poor nigger pushing his broom? Skin color? Come now. How maddening it was for these upper crust blacks here at the heart of the capital, scene of their social successes, to find themselves on the every sidewalk, by every sewer, behind every rubbish truck, face to face with their ragged doubles. Cold and hungry, these dark-skinned peddled so cheaply offended that black pride of theirs, and they were valued so much. We should pity them, really. That night they were caught in the midst of a truly unbearable web of hate, abhorrence for whites, disgust and contempt for their gutter-dwelling brothers, and above all, they loathed for the working class black who had tracked them all the way to France, as they managed to escape the fate of the race in the white man's wake. Yes, the redemptive myth of the Ganges opened many a subtle rift. Nothing seemed clear anymore in these murky waters of impending doom, the waters that the beast had blackened by the design like an octopus spewing its ink. Could that be one explanation? Be that as it may, as soon as the shabby, swarthy troops became trampled, the pavement in front of the Café Odium and other centers of black utopia, the battalions of mannequins took to their heels like a pack of scared rabbits. Still, we have to admire their presence of mind. By daybreak, they had pulled off an amazing coup and saved their skins. Quite simply, they had made the rounds of the neighborhood, a good one, as everyone knows, ringing all the bells and saying something like this to each terrified bourgeois couple at the door. Monsieur, madam, we've come to help you. Since midnight, you can see the handwriting on the wall. No more of these special rights you've always enjoyed, or at least you're going to have to share them, first with the third world workers and later with anyone who decides to rejoin our cause. The streets are full. They're already taken over. Who knows, in a few minutes, whole families may show up at your door. And like it or not, you'll have to make room. They'll pitch camp in your parlor. Of course, we don't begrudge our poor, desperate brothers, the ones who break their bucks or backs working for us folks, the ones you couldn't live without, but the rest of us, students, princesses, professors, diplomats, intellectual artists, trainees, in this or that, nothing, take your pick. The rest of us are men of taste, steeping in your culture and your style, your way of life. Naturally, we want to preserve that elegance and refinement that we feel we owe so much. Clever argument that it usually got them. Now, the best thing would be if we moved in here with you, white people. Two or three of us, that's all. Better to share with us thinking alike the way we do than to be invaded by a bunch of poor, ignorant beggar niggers who don't mean any harm. Heaven knows, but who just won't respect things if you see what we mean, madam. Monsieur, it's getting late. When the others come back and ring your doorbell, you'll really be much better off if they see a black face or two at the door. Come, let us take care of it. You go hide and leave everything to us. Well, I think that's about it for today. And I'm not sure whether you're that interested in this, but it's a little bit of a hard read, but it really gets the point across. It's just like what is coming and what is coming here and what is here in some places, that these black educated people and black white-collar people who wormed their way into French society were now trying to save their ass from the mob by telling the white middle-class people that if you'll let us two or three at a time move into your house and so forth, and we'll show a black face at the door when the mob comes through. So, yeah, that's all happening or will happen or happen more until, like the owner of the ice cream parlor would take that gun and shot the shit out of that nigger, even though they would stomp him to death. The stand must be taken. And if you don't want to take the stand at a certain point, then you'll throw in the towel and become just another white nigger. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, and we'll see if we can dig up some more fun and games. Yeah, right. Remember now, 9 out of 10 white people will knuckle under to the nigger mobs because they just don't have it. And so they will be your bitter enemy when the time comes, and you won't be able to trust any of them. Well, all you people around here in the bunker, what did you think of this show? Well, yeah, thank you, thank all of you. Put the money in the pot. Okay, that's enough. That's about enough. Come on. Okay. See you later.